Essay collections, especially those on feminism, are united by theory, most of which is in jargon and is inaccessible. It's one of the many problems of being in academia. Bad Girls of the Arab World is so refreshing because it's not that. It's an edited volume that gets artists to speak about their own art, educators to speak about their own teaching experiences, in addition to clear-cut academic studies that stand apart from the edited volume crowd. It features essays on politics, society, art, and culture, all on the Arab world. And maybe it's so refreshing and accessible because of its subject. It's about transgressions. It's about bad girls, something every woman is familiar with. My name is N.A. Mansour, and today on New Books in Middle East Studies, we're talking to one of the editors of Bad Girls of the Arab World, out 2017 from University of Texas Press, which she edited with the late Rula Kawas, Nadia Yaqub. Nadia Yaqub is an associate professor at the Department of Asian Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where she's also chair of the Department of Asian Studies and adjunct associate professor at the Department of English and Comparative Literature. She's also associate editor for film and theater at the Review of Middle East Studies, an editorial collective member with the Journal of Middle East Women's Studies, and an advisory board member with the Middle East Journal of Culture and Communication. Her research interests include Arab cultural texts ranging from medieval literature and contemporary oral poetry to modern prose, fiction, and visual culture. She is the author of many articles and a book, Pen, Swords, and the Springs of Art, The Oral Poetry Dueling of Palestinian Weddings in the Galilee, out 2006 from Brill Academic Publishers, and the forthcoming from University of Texas Press, July 2018, Palestinian Cinema in the Days of Revolution. Welcome to the podcast, Nadia.
Thank you.
So we always start off with a bit of a biographical question. How did you come to academia?
Well, it's interesting that you would start there. For a long time, I thought of myself as coming to academia because I didn't know what else to do. But what I've realized recently is that I came to academia mainly because I'm intensely curious, and I keep wanting to learn more and know more. And so really, being a student and to be in academia is to be a student for one's entire life. Is really the thing that I find the most pleasure in. So I began, my undergraduate work was in linguistics. I did a brief foray into journalism. And then when I decided to move formally towards an academic career, also was planning to continue in linguistics. I was studying Arabic linguistics in the Department of Near Eastern Studies at UC Berkeley. And then over the course of my graduate studies shifted gradually towards literature. And then in my work here at UNC Chapel Hill in the Department of Asian Studies, I've done considerable work in literature, but also moved into visual culture. And obviously gender has been a constant theme sort of running through my work as well.
No, I very much identify with that. I think a lot of us come to academia thinking, oh, well, I don't really know what else to do. I really like to write. But then I think the curiosity is a big aspect of it. And I think that's something we all discover is that we really are curious about what we study and really love it. Yes. And want it to get to a wider audience. So this volume, how did it come about? I understand that it was modeled after another edited volume that came out many years ago called Bad Girls of Japan.
Yes, yes. And I am a firm believer in serendipity. And in just sort of diving into new ideas because they appeal to you. So when my colleague Jan Bardsley published Bad Girls of Japan, it immediately came to my mind, there should be a book, Bad Girls of the Arab World. Now that was well over 10 years ago. And it took a long time for me and Rula to conceptualize this volume. And it came about over the process of conversations with many wonderful women over the years, including Jan, also Elizabeth Bishop, Frances Hasso, to mention just a couple of them. But so as we were talking about this, really when it was just a sort of a vague idea, one of the first things that became really clear is that bad girls of the Arab world is going to be very different from bad girls in Japan, because Japan is obviously very different from the Arab world. Even just the meaning of the term bad, the terms bad and girls, would be quite different. So we spent a lot of time thinking about that. And then when we started to invite women to contribute to the volume, had that very much in mind as well. You know, how specifically these terms would look as they're applied to the Arab world as opposed to Japan or anywhere else for that matter.
Yeah, bad girl is such an interesting term when I hear it, because I jump to the term girl. I don't immediately go to bad, because I think girl can often be used as a diminutive instead of woman. And that's one thing I think we all try to be very careful about, is to use the word woman when describing people over a certain age, so as not to diminutize. And I think the word bad is also really interesting, because one person's bad can mean another person's good. Just thinking of Mamdani's Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, which is also the title of an unrelated podcast on Islam in America. This volume defines bad girl in terms of transgression, and even that isn't defined as negative. It's really pliable. So who's using the term bad girl? Is it applied by others, or are others using it to describe themselves, or are you using it as a category of analysis?
So let's start. First of all, with your question about the term girls, and I agree completely. And in fact, I had a long section of the introduction that I had to cut out addressing this point, because one thing I will notice about the volume is that the volume is about women. It's not really about girls. All the people that are talked about in the various chapters are adults. We do not use the term girls to refer to them. Although some of the women obviously do refer to themselves as girls. So we're making a distinction in how we use the term girls very carefully, exactly to avoid the problematic use, which, by the way, I have noticed is really creeping into the language in ways that is quite surprising for someone who lived through the 70s and all the effort that women of that generation put into getting the term women embedded in the language as the preferable term to refer to women. And then when it came to the term bad, part of the work that we did over the course of, you know, the conversations we had as we began to think about how we would conceptualize the volume, is when we talked to colleagues and friends about, you know, oh, what do you think of a volume, Bad Girls of the Arab World? What immediately came to people's minds were the sort of transgressive women who are shattering borders and boundaries and limitations, and a sort of a celebration of that. You know, the first woman to do this, the first woman to do that. And that was not at all what we wanted to do, because it seemed to me that sort of a narrative can feed into problematic perceptions of Arab, Middle Eastern, or Muslim women as being somehow oppressed, uniquely oppressed and only oppressed, and therefore to be celebrated only when they are transgressing their oppression. It also seemed to me, and this, I'll sound like I'm contradicting myself, but if you read the volume, you'll see that I'm not. It also seemed to us that for those kinds of narratives to be the bulk of the book would be an oversimplification of the difficulties that women in the Arab world face when they do engage with or find themselves against their will engaging with transgression. So so the term bad, I think if you read the volume carefully, you'll see that some women really do seize that term and embrace it, and others are a little more ambivalent about it, either with regard to themselves or with regard to the women that they're writing about in their pieces, if they're not autobiographical pieces. But there is this engagement with transgression that is that's the thread that unites all the pieces. And transgression can be something that women do consciously. For instance, you know, Ali al-Mahdi, for instance, when she posted nude photos of herself on Facebook, she's clearly transgressing in a way that she's fully aware of what she's doing, and she's doing it on purpose. But there are other cases where women may find themselves having to decide reluctantly to transgress, or find themselves having transgressed without intending to, or finding behaviors that they always thought were okay, were, you know, and finding those behaviors transgressive. Or, as in the case of the Palestinian mothers in Adania Shibli's article, not really doing anything bad at all, just by virtue of who they are and how their very existence challenges a political narrative that they end up being labeled as transgressive.
I really like that emphasis on transgression, just because I think, and as you said, it can be unknowingly, wittingly, consciously. It's against a variety of what's viewed as transgressive against a variety of different forces. And I also, I think the fact that these women are not extraordinary, or they're extraordinary in their ordinariness, sort of as you described, not wanting to go with the first woman to do this, the first woman to do that, I think really emphasizes just how societies change at the micro level, at the social and cultural level. And one of my favorite examples is the one that the late Rulaka West found herself in the midst of, and it's her account of teaching. And she describes a situation where her students in her feminist theory class receive a backlash for a video they produced on sexual harassment, especially to the second posting of it, which they didn't necessarily intend. And what I find so interesting about that is that one of the accusations is one of West toxification, and that's one that she faced. And it's interesting because a lot of it is, again, how much are you sort of, what are you reading? What are you consuming? And how does your outward presentation of it, such as the production of this video, present as you going against your own culture? And that's what she was, and her students were accused as. And in particular, I think when we write about the Middle East or about Arabic speakers and about Muslims, there's often this desire to create a binary, right, between the East and the West. So how much variation was there in the cases presented in the books in terms of the relationship with the West?
That's a great question. And that's something that we also gave a lot of thought to. One of the issues for women in the Arab world is the way in which the narratives about gender and get manipulated both by governments, states, parties, religious movements in the Arab world, but also by Western powers. So a lot of East-West or Arab world-Western relations gets mediated through this discussion of gender. How are women treated? Is the Arab world more patriarchal than other places? you know, what kinds of aid will NGOs give? You know, does gender have to be a part of every project? So that's one factor. And we definitely wanted that to come out, and it does. In, for instance, Anna Marie Butler's chapter on Aminas Bouy, the Tunisian woman. Here's a woman who, at a very young age, began working with FEMEN, this controversial feminist movement that does these topless protests, and then decided fairly quickly to distance herself from that group. So because she felt that her story was being exploited by this group to make these sort of generic critiques of her society and culture that she did not agree with. So here's a, you know, sort of an example of one of the complexities regarding East-West relations as it gets mediated through women. So the charge of West toxification by Rula's critics is sort of seizing on things like FEMEN and using that in a broad brush way to keep women like Rula from engaging in justifiable critiques of practices in Jordan or at the university where she worked. So it works both ways. And women are sort of caught in the middle and negotiating both what groups like FEMEN are doing, or even well-meaning, NGOs, governments that are sending aid with strings attached to the Arab world, and also what's happening on the ground in the Arab world in terms of using Western discourses against women themselves. At the same time, it's not as if, I mean, that in itself is also an oversimplification. So one of the things that you'll notice, many of the women in the volume are operating between the Arab world and the West. And having a foot in two worlds is part of what allows them to do their work and to live their lives with the degree of agency and that they feel they need. So you have, for instance, state sponsorship of projects meant to empower women at various times in history and in various countries. It's often done in a lead-footed way, but nonetheless, it does exist, or it has existed at certain times and places. You also have, for instance, in Rawan Ibrahim's chapter on the treatment of orphans in Jordan, you have, she's describing a case of social services provided by the state, which are by no means perfect, and are in some ways entrapping these young girls into repeating the narratives of their mothers, but are at the same time providing a measure of support. We can't forget that situations like that, the treatment of children who don't have strong family structures to support them, is a fraught issue in almost every society. If we look at the broken systems in our own country with foster care and the treatment of families, especially families of color, we can see that these issues are really difficult to address, and the Arab world is not alone in not addressing them as well as one would hope that they would be.
Yeah, one always hopes that that's sort of the result of works on the Middle East, work really well-researched, really well-detailed and nuanced work, that it will basically influence, push our eye towards our societies here in the U.S. and then help us see those little nuances as well. It's not an apologist stance, but rather it's one that says that there are all these little nuances that act upon how women and marginalized peoples are treated, and also that there's a diversity in sort of how those experiences represent, and also how we should represent them and speak about them. You mentioned the state, and I'm really conflicted about how to view the state in Arab context, especially because one thing about this volume, and you sort of alluded to it earlier, is that this volume would have looked really different had it come out 10 years ago, right? Because we didn't have the Arab Spring. And the Arab Spring complicated where the state stands in Arab societies, particularly those societies that weren't necessarily thrown into great conflict, such as in Syria or in Libya. But rather those that faced, such as in the case of Egypt, political upheaval, or in the case of Lebanon, which is sort of feeling the after effects of Syria and the war in Syria. So when I think of the state, I try not to think of it as all encompassing, because that gives it too much credit, but they also have a tremendous amount of oppressive control. And then there's also the question of colonialism, colonial legacies, sort of how did they influence contemporary states and statecraft? To what extent do we blame colonialism? So how do we understand the state in the Arab world vis-a-vis women who transgress?
So that also is a huge question, and it probably takes me well beyond my areas of expertise. But I think... partly it relates back to what we just talked about in terms of relationships between the Arab world and the West. So there is the question of how gender becomes this sort of pawn that is used in other sorts of negotiations and relationships. So you might have regimes that attempt to advance women's rights as part of their relationship with the West, and fail or succeed to different measures. But then you also have, and here this is perhaps more the legacy of colonialism and neocolonialism, which is, I guess, not really a legacy, but a presence, a present condition of course, Islam and religion are considered to be backward and traditional, and modernity and women's rights are considered to be progressive and good and the direction that everyone should go. But if women's rights are closely tied to modernity and the political order, the post-colonial or the colonial and the post-colonial political order, which is terribly disadvantageous to the Arab world and exploitative of its people and resources, then you can see how there might be backlashes in the Arab world, either on the part of states or other groups, or just people against the West, but then also against women's rights as a sort of a Western thing. So if you don't want to be Western, because to be Western is to exploit the Arab world. And so if Western is equated in this discourse with women's rights, then you go the other direction. I mean, this, of course, is a simplification. But I'm not saying that, people are thinking in this kind of a binary way. But there's a way in which these forces press people to perhaps along these lines. pressure people along these lines.
One of the most overt cases I find of that in the book, where you're sort of forced to think about the West and the Arab world, is the case of Neda Prouty. And what I appreciate about that case in particular that I want to note is that there's a flexibility with the term the Arab world there that I appreciated. You include the U.S. and Arab Americans because Neda Prouty was is an Arab American CIA agent. And that particular entry was written by Randa Kayali. And it's basically about how Prouty used narratives of Orientalism to reinstate her U.S. citizenship after several accusations stripped her of it in 2007, I believe. And it felt so different from other cases in the book where you were talking about Arab women in the Arab world. So what led you to include her story in this volume?
Oh, I think Neda Prouty had to be in the volume, or somebody like her. And that goes back to our definition of what is a bad girl. We were desperate to include a bad girl that would who was really bad in the sense that somebody that you would have trouble. That most of our imagined audience would have trouble empathizing with. So a bad girl like the superstar champions that people, you know, initially, not everybody, but some of our interlocutors, as we were conceptualizing the volume, thought that we would be talking about, you know, the women who were breaking barriers. Everybody can root for them, or you know the bad girls who are victims. Everybody can feel sorry for them, but the bad girls who make choices that many of our audience for this volume would be uncomfortable with, such as to become a CIA agent, to repudiate one's own family, to perhaps engage in some shady dealings, that's bad behavior. And it had to be part of the conversation. Now, in the case of Neda Prouty, what's interesting, it's very easy to sort of raise an eyebrow at what she did or, you know, tisk her for the choices that she made for, you know, perhaps self-orientalizing vis-a-vis her own culture. But here you have a woman who comes from an abusive background, who makes certain choices in order to escape that. They may not be the choices that I hope that I would make in a similar situation. But it is one valence of badness and transgression that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I definitely, when I first saw the mention of it in the introduction, I was shocked, and I also didn't necessarily feel that. Again, you want to root for a lot of these women, and you do, but I do understand completely that it's a lot more nuanced than simply that she's a really bad girl, but that. You know, you sympathize with her to some extent. But speaking of sympathizing, I think the people that I sympathize the most with in this volume are those women who draw on their own heritage to make their transgressions, to sort of step outside of those lines, because in them you sort of see this blending of worlds. There's the case of the Sudanese female musicians, and then Hanadi El-Samman's entry on contemporary Syrian writer Samar Yazbek draws our attention to particularly how one could use pre-Islamic vocabulary to describe the conflict in Syria right now. So I was wondering if you speak more to that, sort of the role of Arab and linguistic identity in bad girl narratives.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of the value of those two chapters in the volume. And with regard to Samar Yazbek, I think this is a very Well, one thing that is absent from the volume, and it was actually something of a choice, is religion. Islam. We did not want this book to become bad Muslims, bad Muslim girls, or bad girls of the Muslim world, for a number of reasons. One of which is that there is a lot of other great work that's being done in that area. But what this meant is that a lot of the work that's being done in the context of religion, which is obviously a big part of the cultural heritage of the Arab world, is not here. So Islamic feminism, for instance, is not here. And the contestations around Islamic feminism is not a part of this. So Samar Yazbek and her embrace of the tropes of classical Arabic are just a very small gesture in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a very wise choice simply because you don't want to muddle those lines. But also, as you said, there's so much literature on what it is to be a bad Muslim. Another thing I really appreciate about the volume is that you incorporate not simply academic treatments of bad girls, but entries written by those people themselves. They're not just academic treatments. They're, you know, there's Rima Nejdi's description of her Madame Bomba project in Beirut, which involved her strapping these very exaggerated TNT red cylinders to her chest and walking around Beirut, which I can only imagine, especially when she did it, was, I think, 2014, would have been terrifying. And then there's Dia Abdu's mini memoir of being in academia in Jordan and what it's like to be sort of, I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but forced out of that and brought back to the US because she didn't necessarily fit the mold. And actually, there's another case where there's some Islam filtered in her discussions with the male faculty, her superiors in particular. So how do these memoirs, these mini memoirs, and these accounts by artists, how do they fit into the volume at large? How do they fit into your vision of it?
Well, there were a couple of things. So we wanted some first person as well as third person in here, for a number of reasons. That opened the volume up to some more creative types of writing. So it's not just academic works, but also, I mean, Dia's chapter is just beautifully written. It's creative nonfiction. But there are a number of other also beautiful personal narratives, such as Suhair Tal's biography, and then the afterwards by the two women writers, Leila Atrash and Mira Tahawi. So adding that that kind of writing was important in terms of the volume being accessible, being a pleasure to read, and the kind of affective experiences one can have with that type of reading as opposed to more academic reading, and the insights that one can get. The other thing that was really important to Rulla and myself and me was that we wanted to be sure that we had a good blend of women in the region writing about this topic, as well as women outside the region, mainly here in the United States, but also in Europe, because it makes a big difference in how you write about bad girls if you are in the fire, so to speak, addressing the issues of transgression in the Arab world every day, and when you're out of the fire, able to look at it from a distance. And both perspectives are really valuable and helpful. And here again, I can say that the Pruti chapter, but also to some extent, Dia Abdus chapter, by providing some the perspective they provide a perspective of being in the United States whereby you were not out of the fire. You were still in the fire, even though you're not in the Arab world. And that also was important to convey.
I appreciate now, after having spoken to you even more, the fact that this was a very carefully curated volume, that you definitely wanted to include certain things and make it as inclusive as possible, not simply in terms of the voices you brought, but also thematically. And one piece in particular that we've mentioned before is Adania Shibli's piece on Palestinian mothers. So what I really appreciated about it is that it's one of the more pessimistic pieces in the volume. It's, to use your words, it reminds us how limited women's voices can still be. And this was really refreshing to me, especially living both here in the United States, but also in the Arab world amongst certain liberal and progressive circles where there's so much emphasis on girl power and that the future is female and so much on consumer feminism and that if we only bound together, we can get things done. And I think the pessimism is important because it reminds us just how many limitations we might be blind to. So was it important that you produce something that was not overly positive and optimistic and empowering?
Yes, definitely. And here it's that old debate between structure and individual agency and, you know, how much do our choices and actions defined by either of these two things. And I think Adania's chapter beautifully illustrates how structures, the confining natures of constructures, not just the confining nature of structures, but the defining nature of structures, in that Palestinian women, Palestinian mothers are defined. They're not just confined to particular roles or opportunities. They're actually defined by the structures, in this case, media structures tied to Israeli military and state. They are defined in certain ways, and there is nothing that they can do to get out of that. And that's a reality on the ground for some Arab women. I would say that's a reality on the ground for all women in some ways and others, obviously, for some more than others. So yes, that was really important to include. I would say that Rawan Ibrahim's article on the orphans in Jordan is another example of this, where women's roles are almost preordained just by the fact, you know, a girl is born an orphan, her father, she's not recognized by her father. The chances of her not repeating the experiences of her mother are very slim.
So I do want to take a moment before we close up the interview to mention your co-editor, Urlika West, because she's no longer with us, unfortunately. She passed in the summer of 2017 due to complications of a biopsy she was having performed in which her aorta ruptured. So what do you hope her legacy to be?
Yeah, Rula's passing was, it was completely unexpected. It was a terrible, terrible blow. She died just weeks before the volume came out. She never got to hold it in her hand. She's poured her life into this volume over the course of nearly 3 years that we actively worked on it. She was a dear, dear friend. So it broke my heart when she passed. And I think about her every day. I think Rula's legacy, Rula was a productive scholar. She wrote many articles and books and collected stories of her and published her students' writings and writings of women in Jordan. And that's a wonderful legacy in and of itself. Rula was extraordinarily active at the University of Jordan. She was the founder and first director of the Center for Women's Studies at the University of Jordan, which is the first of its kind in that country. She had many other important administrative roles at the university. She was a key part of almost every conversation happening in the region relating to women. She was part of consortia, of symposia, of workshops. If there was a good conversation to be had relating to women in the Arab world, Rula was there to be a part of it. Rula was the most generous and dedicated of teachers. I know this because she taught my own students when we jointly ran a study abroad program for UNC students to travel to Jordan in 2008 and 2012. I know it from talking to other people who have been her students, including Dia Abdu in the volume. And she just gave and gave and gave of her knowledge, but she also gave through example. And I think that is really where her legacy will live on in the consciousness that she created among those that knew her, those that worked with her, and especially among those that she taught.
That's a really immense legacy. And I think it's definitely one that I hope, especially our listeners will take away, especially those academic listeners of ours will take away and remember that's the real work of academia. And that's where people really, it's not necessarily rewarded work and where we need to draw more recognition to it. So I hope that her legacy lives on as a mentor, but also as an academic. So we always close the interview with a question to the author, in your case, the editor, of what you're working on now. I know that we mentioned that you have a book coming out in July of 2018.
Well, that book, it's called Palestinian Cinema in the Days of Revolution, and it's about the film work of the PLO from 1968 to 1982, and also that of and related works by solidarity activists and filmmakers working in other contexts in the Arab world on works relating to Palestine at that time. Then, as far as next projects, I've got two. Well, I've got three actually in the works. So first, in relation to Bad Girls, I've been invited to go almost a year from now to participate in a symposium, which will be sort of a Bad Girls 1 year later, where I will reassess the book and the scholarship related to feminism and women in the Arab world that's come out, you know, since we finished the manuscript of this book until the time of that talk, and sort of do a sort of an update on that. So I'm really looking forward to that as a context to continue thinking about these ideas. And then related to film, which is the other hat that I wear, I have one project that came out of the cinema book, that Palestinian Cinema in the Days of Revolution, which is I discovered a nice cache of documents related to efforts to create an alternative cinema movement beginning in the early 1970s. And that continued as a project that filmmakers tried to institutionalize over the course of the 70s. So I'd like to pursue that and write an article about that. But then more ambitiously, really thinking of the current moment, both, you know, politically, the moment that we're in. You mentioned the Arab Spring, which, you know, sort of, I like to think that we are still in a moment of tremendous political transition in the Arab world, that it's not as if the Arab Spring is gone and passed and failed. But rather that was what we saw in 2011 across the region was the beginning of something that is nowhere near over. And is also likely to get a lot worse before it gets better. But thinking about cultural production in that context, we can also think about the, you know, Trump's, you know, moving the embassy to Jerusalem and the loss of Palestine, but really thinking about crisis and catastrophe and what one does in the context of crisis and catastrophe and what one does in the wake of utter loss. So this is something that goes beyond steadfastness. I'm just at the beginning of thinking about it, so I can't tell you what it is exactly, but that's what I'm thinking about now.
Well, all of those projects really speak to my heart. So I'm very excited in particular for the book, but also to see what your musings on this, the contemporary moment in the Arab world culturally, what it will bring to us, because I have myself of many thoughts on this. So I'm really curious to see what you'll come up with. But anyway, I wanted to thank you for the interview and thank you for the book, because it's really a wonderful addition to the canon on Middle Eastern gender studies and beyond.
Thank you, Nadira. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.